Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are very happy to welcome you on this crisp Sunday morning. And before we actually begin, we have a couple of announcements. The first being, I'm new to this particular computer in Theosophy Hall, so please bear with me if you find that I'm not recognizing your hand for a question or a comment. Please feel free to unmute yourself and alert me. That would be very helpful. But in the meantime, we thank you for helping to maintain an environment of impersonality during our meetings in order that all may direct their attention to the teachings of Theosophy. The practice of anonymity, addressing all comments and questions to the chairperson rather than to other participants, and the avoidance of direct reference to personal experiences, opinions, and difficulties assists all in the assimilation of the ideas of the Theosophical philosophy. We are in with Theosophy Hall, 1917 Walnut Street, and we thank all participants here in the hall for observing the fragrance-free zone so that everyone can be lacking sensitivities to fragrances. Let's open with a reading of the United Lodge of Theosophists Declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. All of the two dozen United Lodges around the world adhere to that set of declared purposes. And so while each individual location may have a variety of volunteers, may have a variety of programming set up at any one time, all of the programming, all of the volunteer work will be intently based on the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. Here in Philadelphia, we are privileged to be able to have three activities per week, two of which are hybrid. In other words, you can come into Theosophy Hall and attend with the other students, or you can contact through Zoom, as this morning, and also attend if you're geographically impaired. And having said that, on Wednesday nights, the building itself opens promptly for library hours. And the library hours start at 6:15 and last until 7:15. There's a volunteer available to help anyone who might want to use the reference library for a personal study or preparation for a class, but there is always assistance available. At 7:30 promptly on Wednesday night, the Zoom and in-person meeting begins, and through the course of the winter, we are studying the Ocean of Theosophy together. This coming Wednesday will be Wednesday, January 18th, and the topic will be reincarnation. What is it that reincarnates? So there will be a presentation from 7:30 to 8:45 with ample time for questions and answers. On Friday evenings, we have a pure Zoom experience available. That Zoom experience starts at 6:30, lasts for 1 hour until 7:30. Friday, January 20th, is what's coming up. We are studying a series of articles in Magazine Theosophy, Volume 16. These are 12 articles that are a synthesis of sayings by Mr. Robert Crosby. And this coming Friday night, we're doing Article 12. Links will be emailed out with the Zoom invitations. Sundays, as this evening, the building opens up at 10:30. Everyone's welcome to arrive, hopefully fragrance-free, if you will. And at 11 promptly, both the Zoom and the in-person presentation begins. Next Sunday is January 22nd. We will continue the month's consideration of the path of spiritual evolution. And the talk for next Sunday is entitled Becoming a Co-Worker with Nature. That will be a full talk, but there will be plenty of opportunity. Please mute yourself if you just joined. Thank you very much. So that will be next Sunday, January 22nd. Now this morning, we actually have a forum talk scheduled, and the individual volunteer who offered to write the talk is unable to deliver the talk due to illness. So I will be reading the talk to you, and afterward, there'll be ample time for questions and answers. Again, our theme for the month is the path of spiritual evolution. And this morning's topic is the pivotal doctrine of human responsibility. What is a human being? An animated body? A mind? Where can we place the limit on who we are? Our emotional, mental, and spiritual self cannot be contained within our physical form. Rather, it extends into the world around us, an enormous field of forces which reaches out to the sun and stars. We in turn exist within the invisible portions of the stars and planets, as well as in those of the Earth's various families. The cosmos is a webwork of these interpenetrating lives, and truly, as the poet Francis Thompson says, quote, "Thou canst not stir a flower without troubling of a star," end quote. If all nature is so intimately linked, how close must our relationship be with our fellow men? Far from a sentimental regard for the rest of humanity as distant cousins or even children of one divinity, brotherhood is the complete interdependence of each with all. There is a constant intermingling of our individual consciousnesses with that of the rest of mankind. For just as we share the same physical environment, we also share the psychological and spiritual environment. Our thoughts and feelings are not conditions of matter or mere abstractions. They are real, living energies that endure, circulating through the corresponding aspects of the Earth's being and affecting the mentality of others. As the focus of these psychological and spiritual energies, a person is something like a radio station, transmitting and receiving worldwide the thoughts and feelings which correspond to the frequency he tunes himself into at any time. We are constantly attracting thoughts and feelings and impressing our mental energies upon them. When a thought enters our consciousness, we may improve or degrade it or leave it unchanged. Again, we may ignore it or through concentration, energize it so it is easier for others on a similar wavelength to attract it to themselves. Thus, we each unconsciously help shape the thought reservoir on which all draw. In fact, the acts of our consciousness are as real as any other aspect of us and have consequences that are inevitably shared by great numbers of people. When we feel or think or do something, we usually feel the results belong to us in some exclusive way. That it is my business, my problem, my credit, my karma. But every act, thought, feeling, or aspiration has potential consequences for our fellow men all over the globe, now and for ages to come. Our consciousness is much more extensive than our bodies and accessible to the whole of mankind, so that our mental, emotional, and spiritual activity actually has a far wider influence than our visible outer activities. Further, its influence is heavily colored by motive and attitude, factors which we are apt to dismiss as intangible. This reflects our refusal to recognize the reality of what we cannot trace with our physical senses. Even though the psychological world we share with the rest of humanity is the main sphere of human activity, our responsibility then goes beyond how we seem to how we are. Living an upright life is not a question of keeping up appearances or conforming outwardly to society's dicta, but hinges upon the thoughts and feelings that we gather to us, our aspirations and desires, and the motives that underlie our actions. The very structure of each human being and of the world we inhabit makes it impossible to isolate ourselves or limit the range of our influence. We share willy-nilly the elements that form our inner life, even if no one else knows of them, because we tend to focus our personal consciousness on our most limited aspects, we usually fail to realize our oneness or to live accordingly. But occasionally, as when on a starry night, the vastness of space draws us out of our everyday consciousness, we sense momentarily an echo within us of that incomprehensible vastness, an intuition that we are connected to all of nature in the most fundamental way. As we consciously try to bring ourselves into greater harmony with the whole which we help form, this awareness will grow ever stronger until it becomes the moving force behind our daily lives. Then we will be fulfilling the true responsibility of being human. To quote H.P. Blavatsky, it is not the wave which drowns a man, but the personal action of the wretch who goes deliberately and places himself under the impersonal action of the laws that govern the ocean's motion. End of quote. Pessimism, anger, and frustration are the seeds of unhappiness. They grow from a belief that the world is against us, that we have no control over our lives. They come from our shattered expectations and the feeling of hopelessness that accompanies an inconvenience or a tragedy thrust upon us. It's not our fault that the person in front of us on the highway is driving too slowly and makes us late for work. It's not our fault that our favorite TV show is preempted by the president's State of the Union address. It's not our fault that someone runs a stop sign and hits us, causing hundreds of dollars worth of damage if we're lucky, or actual physical injury if we're not. The karma argues the contrary. And because it does, we are able to find happiness and tranquility in the face of adversity. For those who do not understand or accept karma, situations of inconvenience and danger are just examples of how unfair life is. They are scores on the world's tally sheet in its victimization of mankind. But when viewed from a karmic perspective, they are simply balanced steps forward in the undeniable progression of the universe, the natural result of the engine of existence. Karma makes us responsible for our actions. Karma holds us accountable for what happens to us from day to day. Karma gives us complete control in a seemingly harsh and random world. There's something very empowering about this fact. By understanding karma, we can be assured we will get exactly what we deserve eventually. Another way of grasping karma is by accepting accountability. Whether we like it or not, karma lets us reap what we sow. Some would prefer to sow nothing, practicing the blind talent of avoidance. If we refuse to take credit for our actions, how can we ever get in trouble? By holding someone else accountable for what happens, we think we can avoid punishment. In general, we view punishment as something bad and reward as something good. Some of us waste our whole lives avoiding one and seeking the other. Those who hold themselves responsible and accountable for what they get in life, however, know they can't have it both ways. They would rather be free than comfortable. They know they cannot act toward pleasure and refuse to act toward pain. They know that life itself is action. According to Rabbi David Cooper, author of God is a Verb, life is not a thing, but rather an infinite string of events, a continual parade of present moments, forever changing, unfolding, and improving. Living leads to action. Action leads to cause. Cause leads to effect. This is the nature of things and the nature of karma. If we are willing to be held responsible for triumph, we have to be willing to be held responsible for failure. Knowing that we are the pilots of our own lives puts us in control. With the realization that life doesn't just happen to us, but rather because of us, we are freed from the chains of happenstance. No longer are we imprisoned by a world that rains bad luck on us arbitrarily. Instead of wailing against the inequities of being ruled like peasants, we become the kings of our universe. Not all powerful kings, but kings nonetheless. With this power comes confidence. With confidence comes choice, freedom, and joy. If we can accept the fact that every situation in which we find ourselves is a direct result of our actions, whether from this life or from a past one, our complaints become invalid. There is no one to complain to but ourselves. Thus, we begin to see life for what it really is, an expression of ultimate justice. Just as we were pessimistic with anger and frustration when we thought we lived in an unfair world, now we can be optimistic, happy, and tranquil because we know we live in a fair one. Though the mind which understands karma knows it has to pay for the past, that is of little account when it realizes it also has to create a future. We are happiest when we have options and are free to act on them. Karma is the blank sheet of paper, but it is up to us to decide what to write upon it. Given any cogent doctrine of ethical responsibility, we are truly thrown back upon ourselves. Human beings can always make a difference by the power of choice in the use that they make of what they know at any level, and by translating what they know into practice. And in closing, a quick reminder: karma never forgets an address. The topic for today is the pivotal doctrine of human responsibility. So there we have one student's study and observations on that, this pivotal doctrine of human responsibility. No doubt you have come to the session today with observations and questions of your own. SL?
So human responsibility hinges on the idea of us having free will. But what is it that we have free will to do? Do we have free will to choose the actions we will take? Do we have free will to choose the outcomes that will proceed from those actions? Where does our free will come from? And how do we know we're acting from our free will and not from some other influence?
You know, in the declaration that we heard earlier this morning, we heard the invitation to fit ourselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to offer service to another. And we do that fitting of ourselves, the introspection, the reflection on ethics and motives, the thoughtful, mindful living of a daily life that is focused, one-pointed, calm, and consistent. We do all that from the basis of our self-consciousness, that soulful realization of I am. I am the eternal pilgrim, the observer, the watcher, the reflection of all. And so as we as thinkers begin to use this self-consciousness, this introspection, this power of concentration and imagination, as we begin to apply that to daily life, we realize that we pivot almost constantly. We're making choices almost constantly. The word pivot is very common in today's colloquial expressions. And we know that, you know, scientifically or mechanically, if you pivot, there's a central point and a shaft, and all of the action oscillates or rotates or spins around that focus point. Well, that's where free will and choice are. That's what the pivotal doctrine of being a full human is about. we have that central point, pin or shaft, that central permanence of soul, of self. And as we use our minds, imaginations, emotions, moods, as we begin to reflect on them and observe them, we begin to focus that force, if you will, that manasic force, that soulful force, on any event or any happening or any passing thought. And so we can choose moment by moment by moment what it is we entertain, how it is we entertain the idea, what motive we bring to the circumstance, how much energy or force we need to apply in any scenario. And the only thing that limits free will and choice is the karmic inheritance of our past lives. So while we concentrate on the moment, making a choice, creating a new cause, everything else will unfold naturally if we focus on right living. Do you have a follow-up or an additional observation on that, SL? No? There's a question here in Theosophy Hall. Yes.
Well, we know that the pivotal doctrine is a portion of third fundamental.
Yes.
And that, what, you know, our understanding in relation to evolution is that we will not, in regards to the pivotal doctrine, we cannot turn our will and our mind over to an outside priest or an outside God. So theosophy then puts it back on us. I mean, it was said so well in the forum talk about our responsibility. So it just seems as though in regards to our evolution, that we need to concentrate on the fact that we are making those choices for us, not a priest or a rabbi, and not an outside God.
Mm-hmm. The questioner actually made a lovely comment about the nature of the third fundamental, one of the basic propositions upon which the philosophy is founded. And the comment reiterated the fact that it is self-reliance, individual free will and choice, that powerful, soulful, eternal core within us that is completely responsible and completely free in the philosophy of theosophy. There's no need for a middleman to translate from a poor, sinful, helpless soul to a deity. That's not going to be happening. The pivotal doctrine in the third fundamental is also key in that if, as you heard in this morning's forum talk, the human being is completely interdependent, coexistent with everything in the cosmos, everything in the environment, at all planes. That means that once soul has achieved evolution and that self-conscious entity is using the human state, the power that's being generated by that soul in all planes of existence affects all of other kingdoms and all other life. There was the quote from the poet Francis Thompson, "Thou canst not stir a flower without troubling a star." So we're reminded of childhood when, you know, there was great joy in tossing pebbles into a pond to see what would happen to the ripples once they went out from where the pebble went in and then returned, and how long they would last, and what the force of a pebble would do to change those ripples. Well, that third fundamental states that once soul is in the human state, all spiritual evolution for that soul is self-devised, self-fulfilled. There's no further natural inclination in spiritual evolution. And the corollary to that is that as soul operates in the human state, all powers generated, all influences created can uplift all of matter, all lives in all kingdoms, or can denigrate all matter, all substance, all lives in all kingdoms. The choice is up to the individual thinker, to the eternal pilgrim. There's another hand in Theosophy Hall.
Well, unfortunately, many people do turn their will and their lives over to outside forces. And that is the cornerstone of the 12-step program. There's many, many good things about it, but it's still very much the outside factor that is involved. How do we approach someone who is so adamant in their belief in an outside God or an outside power that can remove difficulties, troubles, tribulations? How do we approach? Do we leave them alone and let them be, or do we try to counter that in some way?
Well, there's a series of comments. I hope everyone on Zoom could hear that. Throughout the world, there are individual souls who have come into an environment, who karmically are in a scenario where they've been taught to trust an outside source, a personal outside anthropomorphic deity, a religious leader who is their conduit to that deity. Perhaps they're in an environment where religion's not allowed, but they have been taught and chosen to follow a dictator that has political and military might over them. And the comment also included those 12-step programs in which individuals choose, in their effort to gain right living and clear thinking, choose at least for a time to yield their free will and to trust the leadership of God as they understand God. Well, all of those things are choices for sure. And certainly, even within the 12-step world, there are many, many bits of literature that do not define a personal outside God, but rather enforce the view of each individual coming to an understanding of deity in their own right, seeking that higher power within themselves. So we see a range of possibilities and choices. And then the question becomes, when we're encountered with the reverential followership, shall we say, we're encountering a loved one or perhaps a colleague or an acquaintance or a passerby, who is very, very, very dependent on outside sources of power. There's our invitation that silence is golden, that we need to take a pause and consider what's being said or what's being done, and to try to listen, to hear the heart of the motive of the person speaking or acting. And in that pause, as we make observations, we may begin to consider, are they right now content with their karma? Are they acting ethically and pure-heartedly as best they can in the limits of understanding that they've currently gotten? And is it best? Someone needs to mute themselves. Thank you very much. So in that moment, we can discover what we might think would be the kindest, best practice, the best mode of action. It may be that we remain silent. It may be that we see that they waffle a little bit and we can respectfully say, I see where you're coming from. That's not exactly the way I see it, but we probably share much in common. Or if we discover as we listen to them that they're struggling, their faith and dependence on a religious leader, a political leader, a military leader, a family patriarch or matriarch, they're struggling. It no longer works for them. At that point, we have the opportunity to ask if they would like to hear about something that's worked for us, a point of view that we're exploring. And then we might be able to share theosophy, but in a non-threatening manner, a manner that's not going to destroy the inner composure of the other, but a manner in which we approach the other as we are looking into the mirror of self, as two souls becoming one in communication in the moment, doing no harm. Was there a follow-up to that comment and question?
No, not really.
Okay.
There's a chat.
There's a chat? Oh, thank you very much. There's a chat, and then I saw that there's a hand up as well. Oops. It's a new computer, so bear with me.
Would you like it
read? Here's the chat. Okay. Can we avoid the consequences of our negative actions, sin, by confession, prayers, baptism, chanting mantras, or etc.? Now, there's the question that is frequently asked by very, very sincere Christians, especially those of a Roman Catholic tradition. In the theosophical parlance, in the theosophical philosophy, no effort is wasted. No cause is ever emitted into a void. Rather, like a pebble thrown into a pond, the ripples from that cause are going to go out and hit an extreme extent before rippling back toward the pebble that was thrown in the pond. So when it comes to the teachings of vicarious atonement, papal dispensation, priestly confessional absolution, what else? Extreme unction, the last rites, the anointing and blessing by a religious leader, paying alms, doing good deeds to make up. We can rest assured, while those things may offer temporary psychological comfort to the practitioner or the believer, in the long haul, life after life, moment by moment by moment, no karmic effect is ever without result. We are electromagnetic, soulful, energetic dynamos. And what we create and send out into the world and into the many planes of the world returns. But it returns, as the forum talk reiterated, not as a punishment, not as a reward, but rather it comes back as a conditioned experience that offers the opportunity to grow, to learn, to evolve, and to do better. So is there absolution? There's absolution by self-fulfilled and self-devised effort as we work from an ethical motive to do better, to perfect our use of all planes and substances, to purify our heart, to cleanse our minds as we make those efforts and then meet karma as it comes back, the past comes back to us, then and only then can we dissipate the effect of sins. SL, your hand was up a little bit ago.
You go back to that issue of what can we say to somebody who's devoted to some source outside themselves, even if it be most sacred to them, what can we say? And we thought, thinking about that, it occurs that self-reliance, self-responsibility, free choice, all hinges on the realization that we are not the conditions. We are not the body. We are not the feelings. We are not the thoughts. We are something beyond that that looks directly on those experiences, but is not those experiences. And we think that's an idea that, because it's an inward truth, self-evident truth, it's something that transcends any person's belief. It doesn't threaten any person's belief. They can attribute that to whatever they will, but it does help someone focus on the realization that in their minds, at least, they are free and independent of conditions.
So being free and independent of conditions. Again, the declaration this morning reiterated that we are seeking to discover and to promulgate the true nature of self, universal brotherhood, and the true deific eternal existence of soul within and throughout every single member of humanity. And so as we pivot during the day, and we're encountering a moment that's threatening in some way or upsetting in some way, we can pivot, we can spin mind away from that external circumstance, spin it internally, and stop to consider the right cause of action. In that magical moment, we are not enmeshed, identified, lost in whatever the external circumstance is, but rather in that pivoting, in that spinning, in that internal introspection, we identify with something eternal, lofty, that is universal, and that can use the circumstance to the best avail possible. There's a hand in Theosophy Hall.
We were just musing that
one of the doodle.
Someone needs to mute, please. Thank you.
One of the American, we'll call it myths or legends, whatever, is rugged individualism. It was so much promoted, but it was mostly, to our mind, to do with conquering nature and materialism. But it didn't seem to cross over to the spiritual realm. But if we think of ourselves as individuals, and then we should be rugged, and we should, you know, take whatever karma gives us, but not just for ourselves, not the lower self, but the higher self. We think maybe we could put a new spin on the whole concept of rugged individualism? Perhaps?
There we go, spinning and pivoting again.
The pivotal doctrine.
The cultural notion of rugged individualism in America in particular, in the Western world, is a very interesting cultural phenomenon. And straight through from the 1930s on, there was a whole series of novels, basically for little boys who could afford books. Horatio Alger wrote an entire series. The first one was Mark the Match Boy, and each of these little boys in each of the little novels demonstrated the American dream, the rise from rags to riches, the use of rugged individualism, and how the innate qualities of ethics, the pure spirit of each of the little boys, brought them to the attention of a benefactor who then lifted them up, and suddenly this child was no longer an orphan in the streets and ragged and hopeless, but rather would become a dynamic tycoon in business. And frequently in the political arena, we'll hear folks talk about having risen up by their bootstraps or you know, their rise from rags to riches as that rugged individualism, character development in the United States. We know that when we see a myth or a legend or a cultural trait like that, we can read one of those little novels and sit back and say, wow, how is this a twist on an understanding of an eternal truth? And there's actually an opportunity to read any of these premises about rugged individualism, biographies or otherwise, to look at what's at operation there. What role does desire play? What role does will play? How does the soul's identification of self with the personality, with power, or with wealth, how does that become a perversion or a misapplication of a theosophical doctrine? And so we can see this as a cultural temporary practice, if you will, a point of view about rugged individualism. We can look into the meaning and theosophically say it takes great courage to become totally self-reliant. There's great bravery in accepting responsibility for not only our own station and condition in life, but our responsibility to do good for our brothers. The universal call of compassionate, universal oneness with all other humans. And that does take rugged individualism. It takes a willing lower mind and personality, willing to pivot and to spin toward the spiritual, and then act as best seems from that spiritual premise. And I guess in the long haul, as we look across the course of history and through cycles of history, through the Egyptians, the Atlanteans, the Romans, we can do tremendous studies of collective humanity and see how this emphasis on individualism descended into the personal, the physical only, and how it might once again be lifted to where it truly belongs at the spiritual level. There's another hand in Theosophy Hall.
So we, in regards to the rugged individualism idea, it almost seems like it would go together with self-induced, self-devised means and knowing that we are responsible for our own karma. It just seems as though it would all go together and almost prevent a belief in an outside God or reliance on a priest or a rabbi, that mm-hmm. the rugged individualism would could also be pivoted to an internal spiritual motivation.
Oh, for sure. It can be used by a free thinker, a seeker of truth, to take the lessons of rugged individualism and the moral lessons of why did the benefactor in some of these stories, why and how did they recognize the innate goodness of the little boy and know just how to help that child bloom to be all that he could be. We can look beyond the definitions of success, the guidelines of success to do that. But we have to be ready, willing, and able. We have to be seeking this truth. There are many who are still looking for a savior. They're still looking for the benefactor who's going to come and bail them out of their bankruptcy. There are still those who truly believe that they can act any which way they want to 6 days a week, and on a seventh day, go through some rituals religiously, and then suddenly they're absolved and saved again with no side effects. Those belief systems are based on premises that might have a kernel of truth in them, but they've been skewed, misapplied, and therefore the course of a life is way off track. It's way away from right living. And unless and until the thinker leading that life is willing to pursue it to a particular point, usually a painful point. It's usually some sorrow or a tragedy that brings the thinker up short. You know what? My practical, rugged individualism, my obedience to this, that, or the other legal system or ethical system or dogma has failed me. It doesn't make sense. It isn't relieving this recurrence, this cyclic repetition of whatever the pain is. There's got to be something else. And that there must be something else. That kind of a thinking springs from the heart doctrine. It springs from soul wisdom deep within the soul of each and every human being. And we can have great compassion, great patience, great mercy for those souls, even for ourselves as personalities, when from time to time we get caught in the muck and mire and feel lost or hopeless for a time. Esel's hands up, and then LRP.
These statements remind me of something HPB wrote. And she said the value of a theosophical education is to help one become immortal in their individuality and invulnerable in their personality, which is really the definition of a rugged diamond soul individual in all departments of their nature. Not just in the, as was pointed out, in the assertive quality of their will and desire, but in their understanding of who and what they are and their interconnection with all of life. Mm-hmm.
And in that comment, that nutshell statement of theosophy, pure and simple, we see that that sense, that attribute is within each and every soul. But as it wells up in the heart and in the mind, it is the personal choices and desires and motivates that color that and meet the conditions of an incarnation and can misapply it in some ways. There are tremendous lessons for us to learn as not only individuals, but as an entire cultural, an entire humanity. LRP, your hand was up.
I can't exactly quote what was said, but it was along the line of the lower mind makes a decision to be cooperative, or but we have to be careful of our use of language, because there is only one decision maker. There's ourselves as a thinker. We can decide in the lower mind to use just that, or in a higher spiritual mind. But in the meantime, that responsibility lies with us. The lower can make no decision. It's a reflection. It's a use by the thinker. So if we want to change or step out of a lower, it is up to us to make that decision, take the actions, and thereby change the lower mind.
Hmm. And in changing, making that process, that practice, in changing the lower mind, think of all of the planes that soul needs to influence, needs to use, and needs to reinvigorate, realign, to pivot back to. It may be that soul comes into expression in the morning, awakes off of a pillow with a wonderful intent of remaining at one with all of life, all forms of life throughout the course of the day. Unless and until that effort, that intent becomes realized, made real, imagination and focus is constantly honed so that it's focused on that throughout the course of an entire day, day after day, moment by moment, across duration of time, unless and until that process is begun and sustained, then the lower causations, the reflections of what used to be, old habits, the tendencies of the brain and the personality and the body and the psychic and emotional natures, those will maintain strength of their own, and they will need to be mitigated, as was said, by the eternal pilgrim, as best as can be. And it's a process, it's a long-term practice, if you will, but it's hopeful. You know, with that potential for responsibility comes tremendous hope, tremendous freedom, tremendous potential. Not perfection, not a train station on a journey, but rather a journey of perfectibility, in which these choices become stronger and stronger and stronger, until finally the oneness of self is what is the reality. And as the speaker just said, you know, that lower sense of self is diminished or extinguished, however you want to see it. We just have a couple of minutes left. Anybody else? Okay, so let's circle back for a little bit. The theme for the entire month of Sunday presentations is the path of spiritual evolution. And we hope this morning, in the forum talk and in all of the questions and answers that we've been enjoying throughout the hour, constantly what we're hearing is that this pivotal doctrine, the ability and potentiality of existing as soul, as a responsible force and energizer in life, for lives at every plane, for many reincarnations to come, that pivotal doctrine of responsibility, free will, and choice is the key to spiritual evolution, but not just for ourselves. Please take a moment this week to review the Kuan Yin pledge and to realize that the intent is the spiritual uplift of everything in manifestation, leaving not one dot of substance or reality out. Have a great day. Have a great week. We hope to see you Wednesday night at the Ocean Class.
Thank you.